It's like playing cards, and I'm the dealer. Now we're ready. Okay, I've got two questions I'd like to get to today, time permitting. Kevin's speaking after me, so I know he's got a lot to speak about, so I'll try to hurry. And the question is this. It's on Exodus 4:24. And it says there, "And it came to pass on the way at the encampment that the Lord met him, and sought to kill him." Now the question is, who did the Lord seek to kill and why? That's the question. Okay, now a better question, we're going to back up a little bit here. A better question to be asked is, how important was circumcision to the Israelites? If we answer this one, we'll answer the other one. I want to turn over to Genesis chapter 17. Beginning in verse 1, we're going to kind of set the stage here for the importance of circumcision to the Israelites, because this is important in answering the question. It says, "When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram, and he said, 'I am Almighty God, walk before me and be blameless. And I will make a covenant between me and you and multiply you exceedingly.'" Now, a covenant is a contract. It's an agreement between these two individuals, God and Abram. It is said in verse 3, "And Abram fell on his face, and God talked to him, saying, 'As for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations.'" Okay, this is part of the contract. This is part of what we're dealing with here. God's making a promise to Abraham because he loves Abraham. Abraham obeys him, and they have a mutual respect, so to speak. So God said, "I want to make a special covenant with you, and you're going to be the father of many nations." And you think about this time in history, you had a lot of small nations. You had Moab, you had Ammon, you had the Canaanites. And so he's saying, "You're going to have a special nation too from your progeny. Now I'm going to make a deal with you." And this is going to be part of the agreement. In verse 5, "No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I've made you the father of many nations." And at this time period, he didn't have a child. Not by Sarah, anyway. "And I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations from you come from you, and kings shall come out of you." In other words, this is going to be a special nation relationship between God and Abraham. "And I will establish," in verse 7, "my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you in their generations for an everlasting covenant." Okay, this is a contract that goes on and on and on. In other words, you have to remember, this is a special relationship, a very special relationship, both between Abraham and God. In verse 8, "I will also give to you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan as an everlasting possession, and I will be their God." And God said to Abram, "As for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you throughout your generations. This is the covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you." Now here comes Abraham's part. God said, I'll give you the kingdom, I'll be your God, I'll be with you, you'll be a special people. Here's your part of the deal. "This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants. Every male child among you shall be circumcised." Now, this is different. You have to remember, we're living in a culture where circumcision was unheard of. The nations, the people around there, they didn't circumcise. Back between the creation of Adam, I think it was 1,665 years before the flood, nobody got circumcised. Here we're talking to Abraham, and this is 400 years after the flood, nobody got circumcised. So this is a special relationship with a special sign, a visible sign, a physical sign that sets them apart. "You shall be... And you shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskin. It shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. He who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised. Every male child in your generation, he who is born in your house or bought with money, or any foreigner who is not your descendant. Okay, now you notice here it says on the eighth day, that there's a time frame. God said he's going to set the people aside as being a part of this covenant contract, and he doesn't wait till they're 20 years old where they can make a decision on their own whether they want to be a part of it or not. He said, when you're born into it. When you're 8 days old, you get circumcised. You are part of this community. You're part of this contract. You are a participant in this agreement. He who is born in your house, he who is bought with money, must be circumcised. My covenant shall be in the flesh of your for an everlasting covenant. And the uncircumcised male child who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, that person shall be cut off from his people. In other words, if you neglect. If you neglect this, that child is like a Gentile. He gets none of the benefits. He isn't a part of the community. He's on his own. Okay, now let's. What I'm trying to point out here is how important circumcision was to the Israelites as a sign. And there's a parallel account or parallel similarity between the New Testament church and Israel. And it's in Romans 8, verse 9, you don't need to turn there, but it says, you are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit indeed, if the Spirit of God dwells in you. Now, if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, he is not his. In other words, if you have the Spirit, you know, come the resurrection time, if you don't have God's Spirit, you're going to be sitting here watching everybody else leave. You're going to think it's the rapture. Woo, how come I'm not here? Okay, the Spirit of God is very important to a New Testament church Christian, just as important as circumcision was to Israel. It was the sign. It was part of the agreement. And if you didn't have it, you were out. I mean, you were really out. Let's turn over to Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12, beginning at verse 43. Here we have the ordinance of the Passover. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, this is the ordinance of the Passover. No foreigner shall eat of it. Every man's servant who is bought with money, when you have circumcised him, then he may eat it. A sojourner and a hired servant shall not eat. In one house it shall be eaten. You shall not carry it to any flesh outside the house, nor shall you break one of its bones. All the congregation shall of the congregation of Israel shall eat it. And when a stranger dwells with you and wants to keep the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised. If you want to keep the Passover, you have to be circumcised. How significant is this? If you're not circumcised, you can't take the Passover. If you don't take the Passover, you're one of the firstborn, you're a goner. It's a life and death situation. And that circumcision is the sign that says, you get passed over versus the one that doesn't get passed over. Let him come near and keep it. He shall be as a native of the land, for no uncircumcised person shall eat it. One law shall be for the native born and for the stranger who dwells among you. In other words, God doesn't care if you're a natural Israelite, if you're one that comes in and is bought. If you're circumcised, you are part of the covenant. You get the full benefits. If you're not circumcised, you get none of the benefits. Let's turn over to Joshua, chapter 5. Joshua, chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. So it was, when all the kings of the Amorites who were on the west side of Jordan, all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan from before the children of Israel, until we had crossed over, that their heart melted, and there was no spirit in them any longer because of the children of Israel. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives for yourself and circumcise the sons of Israel again the second time. Okay, they were circumcised for the first Passover when they were coming out of Egypt. Now they're going into the promised land. And he says, we're going to do it all over again because we're fulfilling that promise that I made to Abraham. And this was part of the covenant. I'm giving you my part, the land. You're going to do your part and get circumcised. In verse 4, and this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the people who came out of Egypt, who were males, all the men of war had died in the wilderness on the way after they had come out of Egypt. For all the people who came out had been circumcised. But all the people born in the wilderness on the way as they came out of Egypt had not been circumcised. So it's a renewal of the covenant, basically. For the children of Israel, verse 6, walked 40 years in the wilderness to all the people who were men of war who came out of Egypt were consumed because they did not obey the voice of the Lord to whom the God swore he would not show them the land to which the Lord had swore them they would give them, a land flowing with milk and honey. Then Joshua circumcised their sons whom he raised up in their place, for they were uncircumcised because they had not been circumcised on the way. So it was, when they had finished circumcising all the people, they stayed in their place in the camp till they were healed. Then the Lord said to Joshua, this day I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. Therefore the name of the place is called Gilgal to this day. Now the children of Israel camped in Gilgal and kept the Passover. Kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho. So it's a repeat. It's like a cycle. They did it one time. They're doing it a second time. God is keeping his promise. God is demanding them to keep their promise. Circumcision is the promise. Circumcision is so important. Now, over in Acts, to switch gears a little bit, I got to get back. Acts. Over in Acts chapter 7, beginning in verse 17. Now we're focusing on Abraham here. But when the time, we're focusing on Moses. But when the time of the promise drew near which God had sworn to Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt, till another king arose who did not know Joseph. This man dealt treacherously with our people and oppressed our forefathers, making them expose their babies so they might not live. At this time, Moses was born. And was well-pleasing to God, and he was brought up in his father's house for 3 months. But when he was sent out, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of Egypt and was mighty in works. Now, this is preordained, Moses. He's preordained to be the leader that's going to bring them out of Egypt, set up God's law, set up God's kingdom, fulfill the promise made to Abraham. Verse 23. Now when he was 40 years old, it came to his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him of who oppressed and struck down the Egyptian. For he supposed, now this is kind of a key here, for he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, but they did not. Now, what's this telling us right here? Think about this. The people of Israel didn't know Moses from Adam because he was a prince. He didn't associate with the slaves, but he knew somehow, it doesn't say how, but he knew that God was prepping him to be the leader that would bring them out of captivity and set up his kingdom. For he supposed his brother would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, but they did not understand. But Moses understood. Exodus 3. Beginning of verse 1. Now we're going to the official calling of Abraham. We're going to the official calling of Moses. Okay, this is where his authority begins to be developed. Verse 1, chapter 3, Exodus. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he had led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Now you realize this is 40 years later. I mean, he left Egypt on the run. He recognized that he was going to be the leader of the Israelites out of the kingdom. This is 40 years later. Nothing has happened. I mean, he's tending sheep. He's a sheep herder. Okay, 40 years later, now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his brother, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire in the midst of a bush. So we looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, and the bush was not consumed. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, that the bush is not burning. So when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here am I. Then he said, do not draw near to this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt and heard the cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, to bring them up to the land, to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children has come up to me, and I have also seen the oppression which the Egyptians oppress them. Come now, therefore, and I will send you. Okay, this is where it becomes official. He said, come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring the people of Israel out of Egypt. This is what God, for those 40 first years when he was in Egypt, began grooming him for this. Okay, now the time wasn't ripe for another 40 years. So Moses kind of out there in the wilderness tending the sheep, minding his own business. And all of a sudden God said, okay, time's up. It's time to go. You're the man. I've got you prepared. And Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? And he said, I will certainly be with you, and this shall be a sign that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. Then Moses said to God, indeed, when I come to the children of Israel, say to them, God of our father has sent me, they'll say to me, what's his name? We don't know this guy. And God said, never mind, you just go, we'll take care of it. And so he sent. Moses is sent. Now, in chapter 4, we're going to get to the question now. Exodus chapter 4, beginning of verse 19. Now, this is the place where God threatens to kill somebody. Now the Lord said to Moses and Midian, go, return to Egypt, for all the men who sought your life are dead. Then Moses took his wife, his sons, and set them on donkeys and returned to the land of Egypt. And Moses took the rod of God with him. He's on the journey. Okay, now everything's prepared here. God got him set up. God got him pumped up. You're the man. You're going. I'm with you. Moses said, okay, I'll go. I'll go. He's on the way. And the Lord said to Moses, When the Lord said to Moses, when you go back to Egypt, see that you do all these wonders before Pharaoh, which I have put in your hand, but I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. So you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I say to you, let my son go, that he may serve me. But if you refuse to let him go, indeed, I will kill your son, your firstborn. Okay, that's the tenth plague. He's already, broadcasting what's going to happen. And it's still in the future. And it came to pass. Now, here's the question. And it came to pass on the way at the encampment, they're traveling, they stop the encampment to spend the night, that the Lord met him and sought to kill him. Kill who? Moses. Why would he want to kill Moses? Look at all the effort he's put into developing this fellow. And now he says, I want you to go back and do this. But on second thought, I'm going to kill you. Whoa, 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 whoa. Back up. What's happening here? Well, the next verse explains it to an extent. Now, I want to interject something here. This is hearsay. I don't think there's a scriptural reference, but I've heard this before, so I'm just repeating what I've heard. I've heard it stated that Zipporah, his wife, was so repulsed with seeing the circumcision of her firstborn that she did everything she could to put the circumcising of her second son off. Because remember, circumcision was nothing they'd ever heard of. And so when Zipporah witnessed her first son get this, it was a bloody mess. And she said, "What in the world are you doing? You know, this, you know, you're not doing this to me, you know, this other son. I didn't like that." Now that's a supposition. That may not be true, but I've heard that. Then, okay, after he sought to kill him, now in verse 25, then Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and cast it at Moses' feet and said, "Surely you are a husband of blood to me." She knew why God was going to kill Moses. She didn't like it. Moses didn't circumcise her son. She did. So we let him go. God said, "Okay, I'll accept that. You can go on now." And she said, "You're a husband of blood because of the circumcision." Now remember, they were on the way to Egypt. At this point, Zipporah and the sons go back. They don't go along now. Moses goes by himself. Okay, ask yourself, why did God threaten to kill Moses? It was because of a sin that Moses committed. It was a sin of omission. He knew that his son had to be circumcised to be part of the community of God. But he neglected that. According to the covenant God made with Abraham, every male was to be circumcised. Any uncircumcised male would be cut off from his people because he'd broken the covenant. Now, Moses had neglected to circumcise his son. Now, why did this warrant God's great displeasure to the point that he sought to kill him? The reason that God called Moses to accomplish his person through, you know, the reason that God called Moses was to accomplish his purpose through Moses. The importance of this calling is what God is going to use Moses to deliver the Israelites from slavery. He was to receive the Ten Commandments. He was to be the author of the first five books of the Bible. Under divine inspiration, he was to perform miracles. I mean, this guy was going to be the focal point of everything that God had to do with Israel. And he was going to be a judge. Now, what would happen if he was a judge and somebody came before him and said, "Hey, this boy over here is not circumcised"? He'd have to make a judgment. Well, how could he do that if his own son wasn't circumcised? See, it was important to God that he be circumcised. So important that if he did not fulfill that responsibility, even though he was prepped for leadership, God would have killed him. That's how important circumcision was to the Israelites. It was no small calling. And so hopefully that answers the question. The question was, who was it the Lord sought to kill and why? Moses, and because of not circumcising his son. Because circumcision was really, really important. Next question. Oh, boy, we're doing good. I'm going to have to hurry on this. Oh, man. We should have had just one song. Okay, let's get with it here. Some of the key turning points in history that affect all mankind. Okay, there are certain things that are just turning points, right? Like creation, like the flood, like Exodus, like the crucifixion, like the resurrection, like the new heaven and the new earth. Big turning points that affect everybody. Okay, I'm going to ask you a question. What's your feelings about the resurrection? This is a big turning point for mankind, and we're going to be participants, and we're going to be affected by this. What's your feeling about that? 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 13. Now, we're going to have to hurry here, so keep up with me. 1 Thessalonians 4. My finger's only so fast, though. 13. Okay. I do not want... This is... 1 Thessalonians 4:13. "But I do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep, lest you sorrow as others who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring him, and with him those who sleep in Jesus. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will by no means precede those who are asleep. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, the voice of an archangel, with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we who are alive and remain will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. Thus we shall always be with the Lord. Talking about the resurrection. Okay, what's going to change when this event happens? We'll be getting a new body. We'll be getting new responsibilities. And we'll be made kings and priests. Everything's going to change for us, for the good. And we'll skip that part. Okay, question number two. What are your feelings about your children? See, I asked you, what are your feelings about the resurrection? Now, what are your feelings about your children? Let me give you my thoughts. I got plenty of time. Let me give you my thoughts about my family. Okay, now, when you first have children, usually, this is not always, but usually you're a young individual. You're immature. You're self-centered. You're ignorant. You don't know anything about raising kids. You know, all of a sudden, your wife's getting bigger, and then plop, she's not so big, and you've got a little bundle of joy here, right? And it's so small, what do you worry about? I don't want to drop this. If I drop this, I'm going to be in trouble, right? So you're very careful. You count the fingers, you count the toes, all that goes wrong. And then you start reading, after the fact, you start reading. How do I do this? And one of the first things you come upon is pacifiers. Pacifiers are a wonderful invention. You get a pacifier, it comes in the package, you got instructions with it. And it says, before you use this pacifier, get some boiling water and boil it in water, and then, and every time you use it, put it in boiling water, sterilize it. Okay, so you do that with your first child. Right? After your second or third child, what happens? Now, you've seen this. I mean, I'm not the only guy that's seen this. You see some woman at the mall with a stroller and a baby, and the baby spits out the pacifier. What does the woman do? She picks it up, wipes it off, sticks it in her mouth, plop. Okay? Experience, huh? We're learning, we're growing. And after a while, what I'm trying to get at is, after a while, you begin to take the kids for granted. They're not so special, they're not so small, they're a problem. Okay, now Psalms 127 says, "Behold, children are the heritage of the Lord. The fruit of their womb is his reward." That's how God feels about them. They're a reward. They're a blessing. We have them. We think of them. They're a blessing. I want to read you a letter. I just happened to come across this. I didn't plan this. From my daughter. I got it about 17 years ago. I didn't write and say, send me a letter. I need it. It says here, I'm going to read it to you from my daughter, youngest daughter. "Dad, I can't tell you how many times I have written this letter in my head and never got around to put it into writing so I can share it with you. But Father's Day seems like the perfect time to do it. I have so many amazing memories of you while I was growing up. I had such a good life growing up. I owe it all to you and Mom. I want to share my favorite memories with you. Since having kids, I now know that memories that I have are different than yours. One of my favorites is when I called you from the eighth grade. I got caught skipping school, and they wanted me to stay after school and clean the gum off the tables of the cafeteria. They asked me which parent I wanted to call, and I said, call my dad. I was crying when I called you and told you the situation, and you asked to speak to the principal. And I could hear you from the chair telling him your daughter was not going to clean gum or any other item for the cafeteria. I could stay after and do homework, but not cleaning. I learned a big lesson that day. I tried to give that same feeling to my boys. Outside the house, we're a team. At home, we can figure out what's going to happen, but in the world, the team is us. Another favorite is you being my volleyball coach in YLU. I remember we were playing the finals, and the second to last game, we were playing the mellow team. So I was tired, and you were telling me to go out there and jam it down their throats. We beat them and lost to Eugene. What a great memory. Another favorite, when I'd go on a date, and we lived in the house on Knee Court, you would walk me down the stairs to the front door, and the guy never knew where to walk, ahead of us or behind us, but he couldn't walk with me because you were already there. I loved riding with you on your motorcycle to baseball practice. I always felt so safe. I loved laughing at dinner table with you. I've always been proud to be your daughter. It was one of my biggest blessings. Love you always, Vicki. So, if I could do it again, put it this way. If I could do it again, I would spend less time working and playing, more time with the family. But there's a time problem. When you're young and starting out, you've got a job, you've got a career, you're self-centered, you're unprepared emotionally, and you don't fully appreciate the gift the children are. And you waste opportunities. Time passes quickly, and they're all grown, and they have families of their own. Now, I watched a movie called Carpool. It's a family. Have you ever seen Carpool? It's kind of a family movie. This guy is an advertising executive, and he's late for a meeting for a big client. And he gets there and he says, I would like to have a do-over. You know, I'm late, I'm sorry, let's pretend it's just now starting and give me another chance, a do-over. If I could have a do-over in regards to family, I would tell my wife that I loved her more often. And I would spend more one-on-one time with my girls. Let them know the depth of my love that I have for them. That's all I would change. If I could just go back, those are two things I would do. Because children are important, and you really don't appreciate them when you've got them. And now my daughter is 60 years old. Her youngest son just graduated from college, and they're gone. They're gone. They're grown. Okay, what is God's feeling about his children? John 3:1 says, what manner of love God has bestowed on us that we should be called the children of God. Therefore, the world does not know us because it did not know him. Beloved, we are now children, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be. But we know when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we will see him like he is. We love our children. God loves us. Now, here's the question. Ooh, we're going to make it. Here's the question. When Jesus returns to earth and the saints meet him in the air, if they have a small child, who will be there at that moment to care for the child? Okay, now let me tell you, the Bible doesn't address this, so I don't know the answer. But I'll give you a supposition. Okay, now here's some things I come across regarding this. In Matthew 8:10, Isaiah 49, 22-23. Thus says the Lord God, behold, I lift up my hand and an oath to the nations and set up my standard for the peoples. They shall bring your sons in their arms. Your daughters shall be carried on their shoulders. Kings shall be your foster fathers, and their queens your nursing mothers. They shall bow down with you with their faces to the earth and lick the dust from your feet. Then you will know that I am the Lord, for you shall not be ashamed who wait for me. Matthew 8:10, take heed what you do, that you do not despise these little ones, for I say to you in heaven, their angels always see the face of my Father in heaven. You got angels looking out for us. You've got kings looking out for us. And the bottom line is, think of it this way. When we're resurrected, we are not going somewhere. We're just going up, coming right back down. It's not like our kids are going to be there for 6 or 7 months waiting for us. You know, up, down. And when you come back, you're not going to be a physical human being. You're going to be a spirit being. New responsibilities. New abilities, and you will still be a parent, and you'll still be responsible for raising your children. God will take care of it. If he's going to put this much work into you and I, making it into the kingdom, he's not going to forsake our children. That's all I have.